Live from Western Canada, welcome to The Kindling's Muse. Intelligent, imaginative, hospitable explorations of ideas that matter most in contemporary life. And now here's your host, Bill Hogg.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, lads and lassies. Welcome to The Kindling's Muse, Western Canada. We're in the Delta Lion pub, and for those of you listening overseas, that's in Canada. Wow, we just cleaned out the wax from your ears. That's our 2011 New Year's gift to you. We're in the Delta Lion pub, gathered for some lively, hospitable, imaginative conversation about ideas that matter. I am Bill Hogg, intergalactic evangelist, Flying Scotsman, lead pastor at Grace Point Community Church, and I'm joined with two kindling regulars, gadflies, contrarians, philosophical stuntmen, both Kevin Miller and Peter Chataway. Peter Chataway is an acclaimed film critic, Charlton Heston fanboy, Ron Howard wannabe, and Kevin Miller, involved in script writing, executive production of movies, and currently wrapping up a couple of film projects, Sex and Money and Monumental. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you.
There we go. And a kind of tepid response to Kevin's presence tonight.
Okay, yeah, they've all seen my last movie.
That's a bit more. that might be it. Yeah, the critics are here tonight, and we welcome Peter Chataway, Encyclopedia of All Things Cinematic. Tonight, we're here to engage in the ideas raised in Hipster Christianity, which is the debut book from Brett McCracken. McCracken deconstructs evangelicalism's quest for cool and considers the beliefs and practices of hipster Christians and hipster churches. McCracken alleges that we are, quote, turning Christianity into a shape-shifting chameleon. And you've got to be careful how you say that. With ever-diminishing ecclesiological confidence and cultural legitimacy. Publishers Weekly had this to say about hipster Christianity. Being hip is about valuing independence, freedom, and reinvention, but when evangelical Christian culture adopts hip's rebellious nature, what happens to the message of the institutional church? In his book debut, magazine editor McCracken steps outside of his own hip subculture to question whether the quest to be hip is turning Christianity into that shape-shifting chameleon or not. So it's kind of part sociological study, part spiritual autobiography. It's hip, it's miss, and we're going to wade into the book, but the wider issues that it raises. First of all, Kevin, why spend your time and energy writing a book on hipster Christianity in the first place?
Well, I think that something he's definitely identified is it's a real phenomenon that's having a big influence on Christianity and probably how the church is being perceived. So, yeah, I think it's a movement that's worth studying just because it's getting a lot of press. And, you know, who better to look at it than somebody who's really lived in the midst of it? I actually, back in the day, I used to do some film reviewing myself, and I would often race Brett McCracken to get my film review posted on Relevant Magazine's website before him. So I had a little bit to do with him back in the day. But so I know a little bit about that world, but I would probably be the last person to consider myself a hipster.
All right, no comment from us about your hipster quotient. Peter Chataway, what's your hipster quotient?
Well, first of all, they say that if you call yourself a hipster, you're not really one. So if I were to try to estimate my own hipster quotient, I'd probably be very wrong. I mean, I would say it's very, very low, but for all I know, to somebody else, it might look different, depending on, you know, what a person's taste in pop culture is. For example, if you like foreign movies or whatever, that might make you more hipster than somebody who isn't. It's funny because I was reading this book on the bus, and I go to a church near Commercial Drive, which is apparently has been voted like the hippest neighborhood in Vancouver. But the church I go to, Just happens to be a few blocks away from there. And as I was reading the book on the way to the church, I was reading through the bits where Brett's talking about the history of hip and so forth, and then it suddenly dawned on me that I was listening. The music I was listening to at the time was a Star Trek movie soundtrack, and I thought, well, this couldn't be any less cool, right? I mean, the coolness factor just, I think, isn't there. I mean, if you're a science fiction fan, maybe that is cool to you, but in terms of hipsterism, it's got nothing to do with that, and I'm fine with that. I don't really have a hipster quotient, I don't think.
Okay, so, Peter, does hipsterism merit kind of sociological analysis and theological critique and time, energy, and efforts of a journalist like Brent McCracken?
I think it can. It's interesting to me because I don't know how much older than Brett I am, but you know, there's a section in the book where he lists all the Christian contemporary music albums that hipsters grew up on in the 1990s. And, you know, I'd stopped listening to CCM by the 1990s because I grew up on it in the 1980s. So, and reading the book reminds me of how 10, 15 years ago, when I was in college, there were all these books coming out with titles like Virtual Faith, all these books coming out about Generation X spirituality. And I think it's perfectly valid to look at how different generations are dealing with trying to reconcile their church experience and their experience as members of a largely post-Christian culture. However, one of the odd things about Brett's book is that it wasn't clear to me how consistent he was. At times, he seems to be dealing with this on a generational level.
Right.
Like he's talking about people like Gen Y, millennial, call it what you want.
But he's kind of looking at 20-somethings, and then other times he broadens it to look at hipsterism.
Yeah, and I wouldn't have minded a more consistent... either do a study of your generation and make it narrowly about that and going into all the details of that, or if you're going to do a book on how the church has tried to be relevant, then I think this could have benefited from a lot more history, if I can put it that way.
Okay, now he starts out looking at a historical and philosophical review of hipsterism and dandyism, and really attempts to offer us the epistemological foundations of hipsterism, the philosophy of hipsterism. Kevin, how well does he deliver on exploring the underpinnings?
Well, I didn't think he did a very good job. And I think for the benefit of the audience, I think just even defining what does it mean to be a hipster. And I think to be hip is different than being a hipster, because to be hip is to be somebody who's considered cool, whereas a hipster would be somebody who decides what's cool. And the minute that what they think is cool becomes considered cool by everyone else is the minute that you move on from that thing. So that's no longer cool, because if the masses get it, it's no longer your own little exclusive thing that you can claim to know something more about than everyone else. And so I think that's a really key distinction, is that to be a hipster is not to be hip. It's actually you're out on the front lines finding out what's hip, and then you're the one who's kind of telling everybody else what's hip. And then the minute they pick it up, you move on to the next thing. And but in terms of his history of that, I think hipsterism is interesting, because what hipsterism does is say that the categories that you've given me to fit into, I don't accept. And for one reason or another, either I feel like I'm not part of the establishment, or I reject the values of the establishment, therefore I'm going to create my own set of categories that are going to define me and my friends and what's important in life. And so I think as a phenomenon, hipsterism is really interesting. This book, it really made me think a lot about that, is that hipsterism manifests itself, as he points it out, really strongly in, say, the African-American community in the United States, which you can't imagine a more disenfranchised community. And so to see this, in a sense, a parallel pecking order that they've created. And so to see hipsterism manifest itself in the world of Christianity tells me that there's a very strong feeling of being disenfranchised within the church. And so Christian hipsterism is a response to a feeling of powerlessness. So we're going to find a way to get power, and that's to reject sort of your way of categorizing us. We're going to create our own way of doing it. So I'm just not sure that he really follows those dots as well as he could have.
Now, along the way, he offers a definition of a hipster as fashionable, young, independent-minded, and contrarian. And he's talking about the values of individualism and rebellion, really, being foundational. Is that a helpful definition, or does it need a tweak, Peter?
Definition of hipster?
Yeah, his definition of hipster.
Well, I'm sure that hipsters, to the extent that we can talk about hipsters as a group, I'm sure that they value individualism and rebellion. But the fact is, as with any subculture, there's always going to be trends. There's always going to be fashions, things that are common to members of that subculture. And so individualism... You're always going to find people. Excuse me. You're always going to find people who are imitating other people, or people who are trying to look alike, think alike. Like I'm not sure. I'm sure they value individualism, but I think a lot of the time their individuality will end up looking the same. I don't know. But that's a discussion of the actual culture. In terms of defining the word hipster, I'm sure that. Yeah, the kinds of things they value would include individualism and rebellion. But, you know, individualism based on what? A lot of what Brett does in his book is he describes the favorite bands that a hipster has, or the favorite movies, or the favorite clothes, or whatever. And so, you know, he makes it look like hipsters are defined almost by their outward appearance, or by
their consumption.
By their consumption, exactly. And of course, well, who provides all this music? Who provides all these clothes? These are all different brands that hipsters latch onto, but the very fact that they are brands already means that there's a certain lack of individuality, as it were, that they are dependent upon this broader culture of consumption, as you put it.
So, I mean, our principal concern tonight is the collision between cool and Christianity, and like the title of the book, Hipster Christianity. So in the book, he offers a typology of hipsters, says there's 12 types, but of particular interest is the idea of a hipster Christian and hipster churches. So he's identified a couple of subspecies within the species of hipster. How would you care to comment on that, Kevin?
Yeah, I mean, I think he lists 7 hipster churches, I think, and they're very different, the ones that he looks at. I think the real contrast for me is the two types of Mars Hill churches, the one that's in Seattle, which has a Mark Driscoll, who's the head pastor, who's a real kind of beer-drinking, UFC-loving, swearing pastor. And then you have Rob Bell at the other Mars Hill, which is in where, Michigan?
Yeah, it's in Michigan.
Who's much more of a...
A girl? Was that what you were going to say?
I was going to say Woody Allen, like, person who's,
right.
You know, a little, you know, probably Mark Driscoll would whoop his butt in the ring, but, you know, on another level, maybe he would have other strengths. So, show that there is quite a wide variety of people. But again, it comes back to, I think, something positive and something negative. And it seems to be a critique of the broader culture, which I think that Christianity... Like, which is really what Jesus does when he arrives on the scene, is he kind of by virtue of who he is becomes a critic of the broader culture and creates a new set of categories to say that, you know, you were told this, but this is what I'm telling you. These people seem to have no value in the eyes of the culture, but I'm telling you that they do have value. So there is something there in terms of a redefinition that's inherent in Christianity. But I think the thing with hipster Christianity that to me feels a little bit problematic is the fact that it comes back to this notion of consumerism, and that I'm defined by, I become a professional obtainer of rare things. And, you know, I think one of the key shifts that McCracken misses is when as a culture, we went from a culture of producers to a culture of consumers. I think that's a really key fundamental shift that happens probably in, around the Industrial Revolution, where, you know, everyone sense, if you're creating a product and you're involved from start to finish, when that product is done and you sell it to the public, you have a sense of identity that comes from that creation process, where when you have the Industrial Revolution and you have, you know, everything broken down, the fortification of the culture onto an assembly line, you no longer have that. And so you're not getting your identity from your work. The church is being deconstructed, so you're not able to get your identity there. So you now have to find, look for your identity elsewhere. And so that's where it comes to this notion of consumption. But again, the problem is it becomes very exclusive, and that's not really the nature of Christianity. Christianity is about more people being equal. It's about inclusivity and that sort of thing. So that's where I think these hipster churches, on one level, I can identify with what they're doing. But on the other side, I can say that I think we run into some problems because there's a real competitive spirit there as well.
What you've helpfully identified as the hipster churches that McCracken identifies don't have theological commonality, right? So there's a theological diversity, but they do have some things in common. The affirmation of the arts, they're densely populated by hipsters, hence they become hipster churches, they're tech savvy. But what about his typology of wannabe hipster churches? So he identifies Mars Hill Church Seattle, which is reformed. Mark Driscoll would say boxers, not briefs, reformed, so not a tight reformed, kind of reformed charismatic expression, and then a more emergent expression of Mars Hill under Rob Bell's leadership. But what about the wannabe hipster churches? What does that say about the church's relation to culture?
I would say there's always going to be people trying to chase whatever's hot. And so the wannabe hipster churches, you know, I remember this. I was a big fan of the grunge scene back in the early 90s. And I remember being in college and seeing these guys. They'd walk around wearing these shirts. The big thing with the grunge scene was wearing flannel, but then and then maybe wearing a bunny hug underneath or a hoodie underneath, and then you could now go to a store and you could buy an all-in-one. It was a shirt that had that was part flannel and part hoodie. And so, you know, you don't have to go to the trouble of wearing two shirts. And you knew that the minute you have the flutty, or whatever you call a part flannel, part hoodie, shirt, it's the tail end of whatever trend was happening. And I think that when you see the wannabe hipster church, they're just trying to cash in on whatever's hot in the culture.
That I was, you know, being a member of Generation X myself, I was reminded of stuff like that as I was reading this book, because he talks about how hipsters are constantly trying to avoid being mainstreamed. You know, whenever they like something and it's cool because it's exclusive to them, then the broader culture comes along and tries to co-opt it and bring it into the mainstream. So now that the true hipster has to sort of race ahead of it and try to find the next exclusive, narrow, just for me kind of thing. And it brought to mind, you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, when grunge hit it big. And a few years later, you saw documentaries like, there was one called Hype, and it was all about how the Seattle music scene had existed sort of below the radar all through the 80s, and then suddenly around 1991, Nirvana hit it big, and suddenly everybody wanted to, like, everybody just sort of descended upon Seattle and tried to make a big, big deal of it. And you had designer grunge clothes, and you had national music magazines trying to publish grunge glossaries with all, like, the whatever the hot words were. And it turned out that in some cases, whoever took the call from the magazine just made stuff up over the phone. And, you know, and there was this sort of tragic sense in that documentary that, you know, something special about the Seattle music scene had been lost once it made it big. And that's, you know, something that our generation, my generation, dealt with 15, 20 years ago. And so, you know, it's happening again. No surprise, but it's another area in which I felt, I mean, to cite another historical data point, that was just an example of sort of mainstream secular culture co-opting a narrow subculture. Then, of course, you've got the church trying to co-opt the secular culture because this will be a big thing with the kids. It's how we can get the message out. purely by coincidence, today in my news feed, I came across an article in Los Angeles Weekly from a guy called the Crap Archivist, a guy who goes to thrift shops and things and picks up, like, you know, just crap that people have thrown out of their house. And he found a book published in 1966, called God is for Real, Man. And it's a retelling of Bible stories in, you know, Jive or whatever. It's an attempt. And the thing is, I was struck by this because I remember actually reading this book about 30 years ago at a friend's house. You know, when Job and his children are killed and he gets the news, my friend and I, we were like 10 years old at the time. My friend and I thought it was so cool that Job says, "Well, I'll be an SOB." It was like he was kind of swearing, but kind of not. You know, but you know, attempts to cash in on the cool culture have been part of what the church does going back before I was born. And, you know, like a bit more perspective like that, I thought would have been helpful.
All right. Well, we'll have plenty of opportunity to explore the church's attempts to cash in on the cool culture or attempt to position itself as being cool in our cultural context. But right now, we need to take a break. We'll be back for more conversation with me, Bill Hogg, Kevin Miller, and Peter Chataway on hipster Christianity, where church and cool collide. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, lads and lassies. I'm in conversation with Kevin Miller and Peter Chataway about Brett McCracken's debut book, Hipster Christianity, When Church and Cool Collide. Someone who's identified as a hip pastor of a hipster church is Mark Driscoll. And Driscoll says, some emergent types want to recast Jesus as a limp-wrist hippie in a dress with a lot of product in his hair, who drank decaf and made pithy Zen statements about life while shopping for the perfect pair of shoes. In Revelation, Jesus is a prize fighter with a tattoo down his leg, a sword in his hand, and the commitment to make someone bleed. This is a guy I can worship. I cannot worship the hippie diaper halo Christ because I cannot worship a guy I can beat up. So that's what Mark Driscoll has to say. Behind that, the question is that we're going to press into with the phenomenon of hipster churches and wannabe hipster churches. Is the pursuit of cool a legitimate quest for a devoted Christ follower? And the question is, was and is Jesus of Nazareth cool? Kevin.
So you're asking, was Jesus cool?
Was Jesus cool? What do you think?
Well, I think the question would be, from whose perspective would he be considered cool? And is cool a legitimate pursuit? I think one of the strengths of Brett's book is that he shows, especially in the latter part of the book, that there is definitely a collision between Christianity and cool. Because if you're seeking to be cool, what your primary directive is image management. So you're trying to affect the way that you're being perceived by the public. And I know that there's definitely people within the Christian community who are obsessed with how Christians and the church are being perceived by the general public. And I think that Brett makes a good point toward the end of the book where he says that there is a way for the church to be cool, but it's essentially by stopping trying to be cool. And that the church, if it ever does become cool, as in something that other people might want to emulate, it will be a natural byproduct or a happy accident of them actually living the lives to which Jesus has called them. And that's not a life of obsessing over how they're being perceived. It's a life of really, loving others, helping the poor, just basically living the life that Jesus lived.
Peter, anything you'd want to add to that?
Well, I would concur with Kevin, by and large, I think. I mean, the pursuit of cool, no, I don't think it is legitimate. I think pursuing something that is cool is legitimate. If you think something is cool, whatever that word means to you, then by all means you should go for it. But the pursuit of cool in the sense of trying to be cool, no, I don't think that is legitimate at all. As Brett himself says, and as Kevin just quoted, you know, being cool can be a happy accident, as a result of pursuing other things. But I don't think there is anything particularly legitimate about trying to become cool, judging things based on how attractive they make you look or whatever. Though, of course, if you're trying to promote a message, if you're trying to get the attention of an audience, those, you know, image management might be a concern there. But then the question is, to what degree should Christianity really be engaging in that, or approaching what it does from that point of view of image management and trying to make things look hip and relevant and so forth? Was Jesus cool? Again, I would agree with Kevin. It depends who you're talking to. And it feels really odd to me talking about Jesus or even the Renaissance artists or whoever as cool, because the word cool is of such recent vintage that it just feels weird to me to sort of look at anything, be say from the 19th century and then earlier, to look at it and say, oh yeah, that was considered cool back then.
A bit like asking, is Leonardo da Vinci metrosexual? Because that's a recently coined word.
It's a recently coined word to describe a fairly recent phenomenon.
Exactly.
You can always draw analogies between the present and the past, but reading Brett's history of hip was Allison's not here, so I'll borrow her word, of frustrating. Allison always finds things frustrating. For me, it was a frustrating experience because it just felt to me like it was approaching things sort of from the wrong angle.
Now, you both used the phrase image management, where there are congregations in North America in particular that seem to be obsessed with the vibe they're giving off, how they're perceived in the community. Are we cool? They spend a lot of time marketing the product as if the gospel can be shrink-wrapped into product size, and sometimes obsessing over how edgy or provocative they can be. And so when I'd read about Brett's typology of a wannabe hipster church, it was an interesting coincidence that I came across this. North Point Church in Springfield, Missouri, started a new sermon series this month of January 2011 called Whoopee Cushion Life. And here are the sermon titles. January 15th and 16th, Pull My Finger, Sex, Sexual Sin and How Prevalent It Is, How Many People Suffer From It, How Dangerous It Is. The January 22nd sermon, Silent But Deadly. And then the sermon from yesterday was Blame It on the Other Guy in the Elevator. Judgmental attitudes towards people who struggle, Pharisee attitude towards pet sin, and then something the people of Springfield, Missouri have still to experience is the final sermon, He Who Smelt It, Dealt It. So that's it. That's the sermon series. What do we make of that? I just thought, wannabe hipster church. That was my kind of, I thought a few other things as well, but how do you react to that? What does that say about their understanding of the gospel, for example? And I think it's good to be creative, edgy, provocative, because the problem with a church crowd is they've heard the story so many times, right? So there is a challenge for a gospel communicator. But the proponent of this sermon series is accused of dumbing down the gospel and trying to be seen as edgy. In other words, wannabe hipster. Kevin?
Well, I don't know if I would call it wannabe hipster because it sounds more like dad jokes to me. I think it's kind of funny. You know, and I think that kind of thing is, you know, it's kind of fun and creative for sure. I think the hipster to me is a little bit more of a sinister phenomenon because it's almost saying, oh, I'm trying to describe the distinction, because to me that doesn't feel like that's really hip or even wannabe hip. It's more, it is trying to be relevant. It is trying to say, you know what, let's communicate in a fresh way. Maybe we'll get more people.
That maybe junior high boys would resonate with.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're definitely target marketing a little bit. And I think you run the risk of then, if the medium is the message could be taken as really fluff. There's not really much to it. And if the message is so compelling, why do you have to package it in a fart package? You know, that's where I would kind of run into it there. But I think the thing, too, is if people are worried that you have to keep repackaging the message in new ways and people aren't listening, then I think maybe it's just time to be quiet and stop trying so hard to deliver a message, because clearly your actions aren't backing up your words. Because if your actions were backing up your words, you probably wouldn't have to say anything.
Now, I'm making an assumption here, so feel free to shoot me down in flames here. But I think the three of us would assert that contextualization is a valid strategy, is a valid missiological enterprise. But the question is, has relevancy become an idol? The quest to be relevant. As C.S. Lewis said, Jesus Christ did not say, go into all the world and tell the world that it is quite right. The gospel is something completely different. In fact, it is directly opposed to the world. So the challenge is, while the gospel is healing and redemptive and invitational at its very core, there's also a countercultural current to the call of Jesus, and there's a strangeness attached to the gospel.
No, absolutely. And I actually found it kind of odd that Brett would begin his book with a quote from C.S. Lewis, because when I think of C.S. Lewis, C.S. Lewis was a great communicator, and he was great at expressing ideas in ways that were accessible to people. But at the same time, C.S. Lewis does not strike me as somebody who was chasing relevance. I mean, he was an Oxford don who loved children's books, fairy tales. And at that time, anyway, Oxford dons weren't supposed to be interested in children's books. And the fact that he wrote the Narnia books, I think some people have argued it was even harmful to his academic career. That's why he moved to Cambridge later in his career, because he hit the ceiling in Oxford, because he was seen as not being a very serious professor, because he was wasting his time with Christian apologetics and all this other stuff. So Lewis doesn't strike me as the kind of person who was trying to be relevant or to imitate what seemed relevant in British culture at the time. C.S. Lewis was definitely trying to tell people that the gospel was relevant. And so when he communicated it through his books, he communicated in a way they could understand, but he wasn't trying to dumb it down for them. Just as an illustration of that, Mere Christianity, a friend of mine once pointed out that you could call Mere Christianity mere Trinitarianism, because Lewis spends a lot of time in that book discussing the nature of the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. A lot of people today might actually play that down because it's theological, it's not practical, it's not what seekers are looking for. And
right.
But C.S. Lewis puts that stuff front and center.
Right, interesting. And Anthony, you look as if you're ready to add something, Kevin.
Well, I'm thinking about that term contextualization. Like, when you say the word contextualization, what do you mean? Like, basically making the gospel relevant to our current context?
Well, I would put it, for an example, if we were going to engage in a mission in the fictitious land of Bongo Bongo Land, we would want to go and understand Bongizi culture and customs, and we would figure out bridges, ways we could serve the people, ways we could communicate the eternal, timeless gospel in Bongizi idioms. So I would say that's what I would call contextualization, just to illustrate the three of us being the three caballeros on mission to Bongo Bongo Land, which Peter seems to be getting a chuckle out of. I think it was a boyhood dream and aspiration for him to be the apostle of Jesus to the Bongo Bongo Land. So,
no, I think that's a good question, though. Clearly, I'm trying to think quickly through the ministry of Jesus in terms of, he was not ministering cross-culturally. He was ministering within his culture. And so was there ever an effort on his behalf to contextualize what he's doing? I mean, I think what he was always trying to do is contextualize himself within the religion of the day to say, this is how I fit in.
Well, there was a fluidity to Jesus' approach. I'm thinking the often quoted encounter with Nicodemus. He only ever said to one person in one recorded account, you must be born again.
Right, in private, yeah.
Right, and then the next chapter, he's talking to a sexually broken woman who's on the quest for adoring love and intimacy, and it might be argued that her burning question was, can my thirst for love ever be quenched? And he didn't use the born again thing. He didn't say, gee, I think that worked really well with that religious character Nicodemus. Let's put it. So it seems as if Jesus exercised a unique sensitivity to where people were.
His parables as well, right? I guess were a way of telling the gospel within the context of his day. But yeah, I think it's a good question to go, where does contextualization end and this sort of obsession with relevance begin, which it becomes then an unhealthy obsession. Yeah,
and you could argue that his encounter with that woman was cross-cultural because she was Samaritan. She wasn't Jewish.
Right.
Yeah. And so he violated certain cultural taboos and social mores to actually go into Samaria and, as a rabbi, to talk to a woman in public, and as a Jew, to converse with a Samaritan. So that wouldn't so much be contextualization as the demolition of cultural barriers.
Right.
But what we're dealing with potentially is syncretism, where the gospel is compromised in the quest for cool. So, I mean, McCracken spells out a vision for that. He quotes approvingly Oz Guinness, who says that irrelevancy is the new unforgivable sin, in Oz's book, Prophetic
Untimeliness. Yeah.
Yeah. So how did we land there, that we're, as a people, trying so hard to be accepted that we lose the very distinctive that makes us who we are?
Well, a book I've really enjoyed, I read recently, is called The Authenticity Hoax by a Canadian writer named Andrew Potter, and he talks a lot about that, the quest for authenticity, and he would say that it's a disguised form of status seeking, and that I think that a lot of what we're seeking as a church is the same thing everyone in the culture is seeking, is identity. And I do a little bit of investing in the stock market, and something I know about stocks is that you listen to some of these guys who are really good analysts, and they will show you patterns. Stocks change prices according to the sentiment of the public, and that sometimes it takes years, sometimes decades, for sentiment on something like gold to shift. And I think that within the all kinds of areas of culture, the same sorts of things happen. That my theory is that we're still reacting to things that were happening in the mid-1800s. And that as a church, if you look at the rise of hipsterism, I would say it's almost the tail end of Christianity being unseated from a place of authority in the culture. And that this is a way of trying to get it back. And we no longer, it's almost like the end of the grief cycle. We've gone through anger, depression, all these things. We've come now to acceptance, is that we've lost it, so now we're going to try and regain it on our own terms.
Except is it on our own terms? I mean, that's the question, isn't it? If the culture determines that certain things are cool and the church goes in that direction because the culture has already determined that it's cool.
It's almost a form of surrender, I would think.
Because in some ways, I think part of it's an identity crisis on the church's part, because it used to be, until only a few decades ago, you could assume that this culture was basically Christian. A lot of people might not have been very good Christians; they might have been only nominal Christians. But the culture, you know, as evidenced by the fact
might have
that
been like Johnny Cash, a C-minus Christian, as he called himself.
Okay.
Whatever that is.
Yeah, but then of course, a few decades ago, there was a massive change. Or at least it emerged over the course of some time, roughly a few decades ago. And we now have generations of people who've been brought up not assuming that this is a Christian culture. And we hear all the stories now about how kids in school have no idea who Adam and Eve are, or who Noah is, or, you know, just they don't even recognize the names or the stories or the symbols anymore. And I think a lot of Christians have been a bit traumatized by this, and so they're trying to connect with the culture again, and if the culture is moving over there, they'll sort of pursue it. Whereas one could argue that perhaps all along the church maybe shouldn't have been so cozy with culture to begin with.
Accommodation.
Yeah.
I think perhaps where the book's at its strongest is towards the end of the book, where it begins to offer a different theological and spiritual vision, a vision of people on mission. So he looks at the emergent church. He explores why Calvinism is hipster-friendly for 20-somethings. And then, in stark contrast to the consumer-driven, seeker-sensitive model of the 70s, or the deconstructionism of the emergent church, he He calls for a church to be God-centered, missional, countercultural, and authentic. You want to comment briefly before we take our next break, Kevin, on his vision of where the church needs to be?
Yeah, I agree with his vision a lot. I mean, again, it comes back to, I won't take the time to flip to the quote, but where he says that in a sense, being cool becomes a happy accident or a byproduct of just living out what we're called to do as Christians, which is to, you know, love God and love others. And so we then will do the things that the church has done best in the past. And that's, the church has always been best in the past when it hasn't been married to the state or married too closely to the culture, that it's been free to pursue the Great Commission. And so I think that's, I agree with what he's saying. It's all of those things that really we see the church being in the book of Acts, for example.
Bremer Kraken raises questions when he takes a critical look at the emergent church. He says, who are we to reinvent the church? He raises the inherent danger of being married to hipsterism, rebellion for the sake of rebellion, and sends a warning signal that the emergent church takes its cues from culture, not from Scripture. So he invites us to wrestle with Scripture and to faithfully follow Jesus and not get mired in modernism or postmodernism. We're going to take a break, and then we've got an intelligent, hospitable crowd of people who are enjoying the food and drink on offer at the Delta Line pub, and they'll have an opportunity to strike a contrarian note or raise a question with an erudite panelist of their choice. Thanks so much. We'll take a break right now. Welcome back to the Kindlings Muse Western Canada. And it's that part of the proceedings where I grab the roving microphone and wander around the pub to hear from some of those who've gathered this evening and give them the opportunity to toss a question in the direction of our panel. So I'm going to go to Phil with his question.
So it comes out of a conversation around our table here. What is to be made of the trend on the other end of the hipster continuum, where people are moving away from the cool to the more ancient traditions like orthodoxy and more liturgical-based worship?
Thank you, Phil. That's been part of your journey, hasn't it, Peter?
Yeah, I actually go to an Eastern Orthodox church, and it happens to be three blocks from Commercial Drive, and the building we meet in, some of the parishioners actually live there, and they have their own garden where they grow vegetables, and they keep chickens in the back, so there's a lot of that sort of authentic, organic, whatever stuff that might look hipsterish, but the funny thing is, I've never really thought of our church as hipster in any real sense. It's not something that I or anybody else goes to because it's cool. I mean, my own spiritual journey wasn't about looking for cool. It was just looking, for me, it was more about looking for something a little more rooted, if I can put it that way. And so, so our church has incense and icons and so forth, and that's because Orthodox churches have always had them. Well, pretty much always. Maybe not like the day after the first Easter, but, you know, it's been there. Whereas, you know, apparently a lot of churches now are, a lot of evangelical churches are sort of imitating the liturgical approach, and so they're using icons and incense because, well, I don't even want to say that they're all doing it because it's cool in an imitative sense. They might actually genuinely think that stuff is cool. And I would agree with them. But there may be some churches who are doing it because they think this is what the kids want, because it's more stylish now or trendy or whatever to have candles and incense and so forth, as opposed to meeting in like a giant gym with a worship band or something. So... So the danger there in the evangelical context is that if you're doing these things because it's trendy, well, then, of course, you know, 5 years from now, something else could be fashionable, and you'll drop that, and you'll do something else. I mean, one of the dangers that Brett talks about in his book is... there's cheering behind me. I don't know why. One of the dangers...
It's because we love you, Peter.
Oh, thank you. That's why it is. One of the things he talks about in his book is how the evangelical church frequently taps into whatever's popular and then drops it, and then picks it up and then drops it, picks it up and then drops it. As a Christian music, I wouldn't say I'm a fan of what's currently on the scene because I have no idea what's on the scene, but as a fan of the music I grew up on, I know that it's been interesting to me how a lot of vintage Christian music simply isn't available anymore, whereas a lot of the classics on the secular scene, you know, are preserved and they're held on to, and you can get greatest hits albums and reissues and all the rest of it, whereas a lot of older Christian rock just sort of, once it served its purpose, it's gone. And I was reminded of how a couple years ago I was asked to write an article on the Passion of the Christ 5 years later to see what sort of impact it had had, what sort of lasting legacy it had left, that sort of thing. And when the movie first came out, I interviewed a bunch of people to talk about it. So 5 years later, I figured, well, I'll go to those same people and I'll start there and I'll see, like, you know, I'll see what they have to say. And the people I got through to generally were like, we don't really think about it. It's even something like the Passion of the Christ was so 5 years ago, you know, that it was the thing that they latched onto then, and then they sort of dropped it. And so that's always a concern. For me, one of the benefits of a liturgical approach is simply knowing that this is what Christians around the world are doing, and it's what Christians have been doing throughout the ages. I mean, liturgy does change over the years, but there's a continuity to it that in its own way, I guess, to me, feels organic and authentic, if I can use those hipster words. But...
I'm sure you can, and you just did.
I guess so, I just did, yeah.
So that makes you a hipster after all.
Oh, darn.
Darn. Kevin, anything you'd want to add about this journey towards the historic, away from the immediate, the disposable, to the liturgical, and maybe the transcendent even?
Well, it's funny because our family has also made a move in the last couple of years toward a more liturgical church. We're in the Anglican church, and coming from a... You know, I guess for me, it's a little bit of a return to my roots because I grew up in the United Church, which had forms of Anglicanism, but it was out of probably a decade or more long quest to just really return to an organic, authentic form of Christianity, but more just to become part of a, like Peter said, you know, tying into something that Christians have been doing throughout the history of the church, at least in terms of a form, and that throughout the world as well, in terms of some broader community, whereas I felt so often I was involved in non-denominational evangelical churches that were really out there in no man's land, and really by what authority are we even existing, and sort of who are we accountable to, and these types of questions that were rising in my head. So for me, the move in that direction was just, I believe, a legitimate inward quest, and in that it wasn't really a way of seeking status with others. In fact, we probably lost a lot of status as a result of what we did. But I agree that there's also other churches out there who will take whatever's hip. And yeah, I think it's the early church fathers is something that you'll hear a lot of people quoting these days. And it's a way of, again, saying, I think it's almost a form of Gnosticism sometimes for people, that I know something that other people don't know. I have some kind of special little thing that other people don't know about, and so that makes me cool. And I don't know, I'm sure that's going on as well, but I think for a lot of people it's a legitimate quest to kind of get the baby back that went out with the bathwater. So.
Right. Phil, anything you'd want to add to that or come back to either Kevin or Peter in response to your question? No? Okay. We're going to shuffle over to Donna, who's got a question about hipsterism.
Oh, well, if I can just preface this with, in his book, he talks about, as growing up as a child, his prologue, he says he wasn't cool in high school, but he wanted to be cool somewhere. So in his church, he was cool. He was a youth leader, and he rose to the top, and everyone admired him and loved him for what he was doing at the church. But in mainstream life, he wasn't cool. And my question basically is, isn't hipsterism just another form of individualism, like people wanting to be cool, to be individuals, to rise to the top, to have everyone notice them, but isn't that counterproductive to what the gospel is actually preaching?
Thanks, Donna. Kevin, we'll start with you.
Yeah, well, I think that's, he talks a lot about that in his book, is that, I think that the interesting thing about bread is that I feel that probably the first 80, 90% of his book, to me, is him building up the nerve to say what he actually wants to say. And he's so enmeshed in the hipster culture that he risks alienating himself from a lot of his friends and from that community by what he has to say in the end of the book. He even prefaces what he says toward the end of the book by saying, I'm going to now say that Christianity and cool are incompatible, but I'm reserving the option to change my mind, or, you know, he's being a little bit facetious there, but he comes out pretty strongly. He actually has a checklist in here, which I thought was pretty useful, where he lists all the attributions of hipsterism and then all the attributions of Christianity, and shows that they're pretty much diametrically opposed, you know, in terms of one being really exclusive and really self-defeating, the other being inclusive, one being self-centered, one being other-centered, that sort of thing. So,
Peter.
The question again?
Wow. Welcome back to the land of the living.
No, I was just so enthralled with Kevin's answer.
Peter's going back to the world of dandyism, where he finds his hipster roots. So, 21st century Peter, Del the Line pub.
That's right. Well,
as I
recall, the question is something to do with isn't hipsterism and individualism
espousing an individualism counterproductive? That's counter to the gospel.
Counter to the gospel. Yeah, I would agree with Kevin that the checklist in there is a useful one. The gospel calls us to love God with all our heart, mind, soul, strength, and to love our neighbor as ourselves. And it's not about us in a way. So anything that focuses on ourselves and how hip or cool we are would be antithetical to that. If Brett does say in the book that anything that coolness should be at best a happy accident as a result of pursuing what is right. If the gospel seems cool to some people, that's great, but it's not what it's about. Ultimately, what counts is what's true, I guess. And the truth is not always cool. The truth is not always popular. That's what we're called to, is the truth, not to what's cool. So, if that means that hipsterism is opposed to the gospel in some way, then so be it, I guess.
So faithfulness to the revealed truth trumps coolness, hipsterism, and relevance at every turn. Right? Good thoughts, Peter. Thanks. So as we wrap up another Kindlings, look forward to our Oscars installment next month. Kevin, we like to land on a concluding thought, just to kind of wrap up the issue and point us forward, a kind of, okay then, so what? And, you know, to quote Francis Schaeffer, how should we then live? And we've already said that the quest for cool and the quest to be hip are unhelpful distractions, maybe, or rabbit trails. But as we look at either the church or the call of an individual, a Christ follower, any thoughts just to wrap up with in response to what you've waded through in Brett McCracken's Hipster Christianity?
Yeah, well, you know, it always prompts some healthy self-examination to think about, you know, how this affects me, and especially me being a writer and being involved in an industry that is full of status seeking, and you know, just thinking about how this plays into my own life. I guess a book like this for me, just, it makes me think a lot about how do I fit into this phenomenon that's going on? How much have I allowed the culture to set the agenda for, you know, how I'm living my life, as opposed to really letting Christ set that agenda and looking inward and looking to him to say, who am I? As opposed to looking outward and saying, who do I want to be like, or who do I want people to think I am? So for me, I guess that's maybe the best thing to come away with is to look at this as a mirror and say, how have I fallen prey to this, and how might I live differently as a result of knowing that?
Thanks, Kevin. Peter.
I guess the central issue for me is that the quest or the pursuit that some people have to make the church cool or relevant, or to make Christianity cool or relevant to other people, to me seems somewhat wrong-headed, because it almost implies that Christianity is lacking something somehow, that it needs something else to make it sell. And I think what we have to keep remembering is that the truth as revealed in Christ and as revealed through his body, the church. The church has the scriptures, the church has Christ, not has Christ, we testify to him. In a sense, instead of people being taught that the church can be relevant to them, this may sound odd, I'm not quite sure the best way to put it, but maybe it should be reversed to the people. I can't say people should be relevant to the church, because of course people are relevant to the church. Everyone's made in God's image. The focus should ultimately not be on how we can get people to like the church. How to put this? It's a complicated issue, but the focus ultimately should be Christ-centered, not on other people. That is, other people should not be the center of the story. You know, they should be drawn to Christ because he is the center of the story.
Could I put it this way? Yeah. What you're trying to say is that we shouldn't be focused on getting people to like the church, but getting focused on the church loving other people? Like, is that what you're saying?
Well, that's part of it. But speaking as a person myself, as a member of that group collectively known as people, the thing that I constantly have to learn is that I need to model myself after Christ. I need to follow him. I need to put him first, all that stuff. And the thing is, other people, and I believe that other people need to learn that too. I believe other people need to focus on Christ and be drawn towards him as well. I guess I'm leery of watering that down by sort of trying to sell people sort of a cool Christianity or a Christianity that sort of tells them what they already believe and what they already feel they need to know. You know, I don't like the idea of people looking at Christianity and saying, "Oh yeah, I agree with that. Okay, sure, I'll pick up one of those and stick it in my back pocket." That, you know, people need to know that becoming Christian does affect your life and how you orient your life. Something like orientation. I feel that word orientation.
Orientation. So yeah. Having an individual and collective orientation around Christ, so that we're shaped by Jesus, and the church gets its agenda from Jesus, rather than the shifting sands of our culture, which is fickle and faddish. So there we have it. Another kindlings. Come and grab it. Yeah, okay, sure. We're wrapping up, but here we go.
Just something quick. I just want to know if this is more of like a North America phenomenon. Like, or did he cover that at all in the book? I never read the book, but...
Well, in the book, Brett suggests that America is the home of hip, that America is a nation founded on rebellion and individualism and so forth. And so he would argue that hipsterism is sort of naturally more American than anything else, I guess. But although he does cite antecedents in medieval Europe or Renaissance Europe and so forth, but I'm not sure if that's true. I don't know, because when I think hip, I think Paris sidewalk cafes and stuff. You know, you could find hip things anywhere, I think, but I don't know.
He does reference at least one church in London.
That's true.
Yeah, but. Yeah, and I would take issue with his whole argument about America being the home of hipsterism, but yeah.
Maybe the home of consumerism.
Yeah.
And if you remember a book, A Blast from the Past, Oz Guinness's Gravedigger Files, how the history of the church in America is kind of set up as competing enterprises on the street corner. So that sets you up for some of this market-driven consumerist spirituality, even back in the foundation of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So there we are. Thanks for that question, and thanks for joining us this evening. Obviously, if you found the podcast, what I'm about to say is completely superfluous, but for those of you here at the Delta Line Pub, you find our podcast, this podcast, and archives of other ones at www.thekindlings.ca, and this will be uploaded probably a couple of days from now. You'll find that on the website. But thanks so much for spending an evening with us, and we're reminded, don't follow the shape-shifting chameleon of cool. Don't follow the hologram of hipsterism, but be shaped by the always troubling, always healing, always countercultural Jesus of Nazareth. Thanks so much for joining us this evening.